Welcome to Royally Screwed. My name is Chris Shearer, and it's my honor to take you on a tour through some of history's greatest, worst, and bizarre rulers. It's time for another installment of Were They Great, where we explore the reigns of rulers who were given the title The Great in order to determine if they really deserved that honor. In this installment, we're talking about the founder of the Achaemenid Persian Empire, Cyrus II. Surprisingly, this is not the first time I've talked about Cyrus on this show. I believe he's come up at least a couple of times in previous episodes. Once in the last episode I did about a Persian emperor, and surprisingly, the episode I did over King David and the history of the Israelites. The Achaemenid Persians were a very big deal in the ancient world, so obviously their founder would need to receive equal acclaim. Before his reign, Persia was only a bit player in the larger scheme of the ancient West Asian landscape. However, by Cyrus's death, his empire was on the way to becoming the largest nation in the world at that period in history. Along the way, he conquered foes of biblical proportions, quite literally in this case, as I'll get into later. Like last episode over Constantine the Great, I'm kinda showing my hand here about how I feel about Cyrus up front. The concept of a Persian empire would outlast the Achaemenids, but it really all started with them, and Cyrus put that empire on the map. This is a Were They Great episode though, so we'll have to do a little deeper digging than just saying he started an empire. Empires are a dime a dozen in history, and anyone can be a conqueror. What did Cyrus do after he conquered his neighbors that made him be remembered as Cyrus the Great? Was it worth giving him that historically significant epitaph? So, without further ado, let's begin the story. We're going back in time to Western Asia in the 6th century BCE in Cyrus II of Persia. Was he great? Before we look into the early days of Persia and the Achaemenid dynasty, let's take a look at the general playing field of Western Asia in the late days of the Iron Age. In the 7th century BCE, the big name in the field was the Neo-Assyrian Empire. The Assyrians lived in an area that straddles several modern nations, but was mainly centered in northern Iraq. Over the course of about 1,500 years, the Assyrians grew and conquered their various neighbors until they ruled over territory ranging from eastern Iran to western Egypt. In the late 7th century, the Neo-Assyrian Empire started to unravel as all of the people they had conquered started to revolt. The two main parties who led this rebellion were the Medes and the Babylonians. The Medes, from Media, were an Iranian people. The Babylonians were from the famous ancient city of Babylonia in modern-day Iraq. Together, they toppled the Neo-Assyrian Empire. The Medes originally retook control of their homeland in western Iran until they eventually coalesced power and took over what had essentially been the northern half of the Neo-Assyrian Empire. The Babylonians took over most of the remaining territory in Iraq and the Levant, with a bit more territory in the Western Arabian Peninsula. Egypt regained a bit of its land and autonomy. The final major player was the Lydians, who controlled the Asia Minor Peninsula in modern-day Turkey. So with that now explained, where does Persia fit into this? First things first though, in modern times, or at least closer to modern times, the terms Persia and Iran were basically synonyms. However, Persia is actually just a region within Iran. It's like how some people call the Netherlands Holland when Holland itself is only a part of the Netherlands. The Persian people were originally a nomadic tribe that eventually settled in the Zagros mountain region of western Iran. They lived alongside the Elamites, another western Iranian people. The Elamites were the older and more established of the two groups, having lived in the region since at least the early 2000s BCE. The Achaemenid dynasty allegedly started with the rule of Achaemenes, a possibly fictitious Persian man who eventually found himself ruling over the Elamite city of Anshan. Achaemenes then built up his own kingdom called Parsua. This kingdom grew to eventually take control of the region known as Pars, now the Iranian province of Fars, which is also called Persis, aka where the Persians lived. Achaemenes is claimed to be the great-great-grandfather of Cyrus the Great, though this lineage was only later stated by Emperor Darius I. Cyrus himself never made mention of Achaemenes as his ancestor. Cyrus's actual lineage begins with his grandfather, also named Cyrus, and he ruled Anshan as Cyrus I. Cyrus I was succeeded by his son, Cambyses I. During all of this, the Achaemenid dynasty possibly ruled as vassals to the more powerful Median Empire. No ancient Persian sources claim Median overlordship, but later Greek sources do, so who knows what the story was there. The ruler of the Medes at this time was a man named Astyages. Perhaps to raise his standing with his Median overlord, Cambyses married one of Astyages' daughters, Mandane. According to Herodotus, a Greek historian you can only sometimes count on who also first said that the Persians served the Medes, Astyages once had a dream that Mandane grew a vine from her body that went on to cover all of Asia. When he asked his scholars to interpret this dream, they told him that a son of Mandane would go on to conquer all of that territory, aka the lands Astyages ruled over. Since Cambyses was of a much lower standing than Astyages, the Median king allowed the marriage as he did not believe any grandchild through that marriage would be able to topple his power. Well, around 600 BCE, Cambyses and Mandane had a son. In Persian, his name was Kurosh. Through Greek, we get the name Cyrus. In 559 BCE, Cambyses I passed away, leaving the throne to his son. And though he was potentially under the thumb of his grandfather, it was only a matter of time before Cyrus started working to conquer his known world. Let's get things started right off the bat by talking about how Cyrus started building his empire. Obviously, as a possible vassal to the much more powerful Medes, he had to take over their territory first. Two separate Babylonian sources possibly provide the dates for the Persian conquest of Media, with a mostly agreed upon time being from 553 to 550 BCE. In the several decades leading up to this, Media and Babylon had been pushing back and forth against each other. Basically, everyone in both nations were worried about the threat of all-out war, though it never came to that. It also led to a collapse in trust towards the rulers of both nations. In Media, this was especially troubling for Astyages. Apparently, one of his generals named Harpagus had decided to rebel against the king. While some nobles and citizens of Media were defecting to Babylon, Harpagus decided to approach Cyrus with an offer of cooperation. If the king of the Persians was to wage war against the Medes, a group of Median nobility would join him in the cause. Cyrus convened a council of Persians and told them that life could be better without Media being a constant force of contention, whether that was as an overlord or just an annoying larger neighbor. So, Cyrus declared war against the Medes. In the first battle of the Medo-Persian conflict, as it's named, Astyages opted to sit out, letting Harpagus take control. Well, considering he was possibly the one who instigated all of this, Harpagus met Cyrus on the field of battle and immediately defected, with most of his army following suit. This led Astyages to lead the remainder of his army against Cyrus for a second battle, where the Persians came out on top. From there, Astyages' fate is left vague. Some say he was killed outright. Others say he was taken prisoner before being given his freedom, only to serve as an advisor under Cyrus. This was all from Herodotus, by the way. Other ancient Greek sources say that Cyrus's war with the Medes was a much harder fought affair, with Cyrus losing several battles in succession before finally defeating Astyages in combat. When Cyrus then took the Median capital of Ecbatana, he further solidified his place by marrying Astyages' daughter, Amytis. If you're remembering correctly, that would indeed make her his aunt. Nevertheless, Cyrus had now placed himself on the map as a powerhouse in Western Asia. His empire was beginning to come together. But Cyrus was obviously far from done. There were still three other powerhouses in the area that had once been under Assyrian dominion. It's believed that the next lands Cyrus conquered were his western neighbors, the Lydians in modern Turkey. Now, when Cyrus conquered the Medians, he would have held power over a huge swath of territory that extended into the north-central region of Turkey. That's to say that the conquest of Lydia began when the Lydian king Croesus attacked the Achaemenid Persian city of Pteria in northern Turkey. Croesus was a powerful king and apparently one of the richest men alive at this point in history. He eventually became a massive semi-legendary figure for the ancient Greeks. There's a Greek legend that, before launching his attack, Croesus sought advice from the Oracle of Delphi, aka the most famous oracle within Greekdom, who responded that, should Croesus wage war, a great empire would fall. Well, not to spoil a point that I already made, but an empire sure would fall from Croesus' actions, and it wouldn't be Cyrus's. After Croesus' instigation, Cyrus thought he would be able to get a hand from the Ionian Greeks, aka the Greek population living on the Mediterranean shores of Asia Minor. Unfortunately, he was unable to get them to agree. Perhaps if he had gotten them on his side, the Lydian campaign wouldn't have been as drawn out, which it wasn't to begin with. We don't know when exactly Cyrus and Croesus decided to butt heads, but the generally agreed upon year is 547 BCE. The two armies initially fought each other at Pteria, though this battle would end with the Persians suffering heavy casualties and the Lydians retreating further within their borders. Croesus was planning on holding out over winter while his allies gathered. Unfortunately, Cyrus decided to keep on marching. I'd go on a whole diatribe here about how war used to have unspoken rules, but I don't think there's time for that. Basically, you just didn't fight during the heights of winter. Needless to say, Cyrus's march greatly surprised the Lydians. While Croesus tried to retreat to the safety of Sardis, the Lydian capital, Cyrus caught up with his army just outside of the city at nearby Thymbra. It's in recounting this battle that we get another fun anecdote from Herodotus, and I want this one to be true even if it is just a story. Harpagus, the same guy who initiated Cyrus's rebellion, instructed the Persian king to use camels on the front line instead of horses. Apparently, the Lydian horses would find this confusing and unnerving, I guess due to the smell of the camels? Well, when Cyrus employed this strategy, the horses used by the Lydian cavalry freaked out. The riders were unhorsed and trampled, and several other soldiers were injured or killed by horses in the ensuing confusion. Croesus was once more forced to retreat, where he made it safely into Sardis. However, after 2 weeks, during which the Persians laid siege to the Lydian capital, Cyrus pushed in and took the city. Again, different historians report different outcomes for Croesus. Some say he became one of Cyrus's advisors. Others say he was killed. Either way, the Lydians were out of the way. Cyrus controlled such a huge territory that his immediate western neighbors were Greek and his eastern neighbors were Hindus. But still, there was one last great kingdom to conquer. Cyrus's next major campaign would push him south to take on the might of Babylon. From 545 to 540 BCE, Cyrus spent much of his time waging war and conquering the lands further east of his dominions. He conquered many of the kingdoms that occupied Central Asia in Afghanistan, Turkmenistan, Uzbekistan, and Tajikistan. The only military campaign he failed at during this time was against the region of Jidrosha, which straddles the coast of southeastern Iran and western Pakistan. Jidrosha would later be conquered by Cyrus's successors. At this point in time, Babylon was ruled by King Nabonidus. It's records from his court that provide most of the information we now use to decode dates and times for the different conquests Cyrus engaged in. Also, as I mentioned before, Babylon had been in a period of unrest. While this had originally been due to struggles with the Medes, things sure didn't get all that much better with Persia now the massive new force in town. This was apparently exacerbated by Nabonidus' unpopularity. Now, how unpopular he actually was is unknown. All we have to go on is Cyrus' post-conquest propaganda, which of course is going to try to make his enemies seem much less favorable. What's believed, though, is that Nabonidus was trying to change the state religion of his empire, moving away or otherwise diminishing the power of Babylon's patron deity, Marduk. Well, since he had already conquered the land surrounding it to the north, east, and northwest, Cyrus might as well continue on to conquer the Neo-Babylonians. And he would. In late 540 BCE, Cyrus began raiding along Babylonia's northern borders. By the end of the year, Nabonidus was apparently trying to concentrate all of his power within Babylon itself. Throughout the next year, Cyrus continued pushing into his southern neighbor, finally delivering the final blow at the Battle of Apis in late September of 539 BCE. According to all of the ancient texts, aka Cyrus's propaganda, the Persian emperor was able to take the city of Babylon itself without a struggle. Again, maybe a bit too self-serving on Cyrus's part, because later Greek sources insist he laid siege to the city. And as per usual now with this story, Nabonidus's fate is kinda left up in the air as to whether he was outright killed or taken as a prisoner. Nonetheless, Cyrus's conquest of the Neo-Babylonian Empire was a massive status quo change throughout all of Western Asia. First and foremost, Achaemenid Persia was now the largest nation in the world. It would continue to grow, but it would maintain that title until it was conquered and absorbed into the empire of Alexander the Great 200 years later. He now owned land that was the seat of ancient civilizations: the Assyrians, the OG Babylonians, the Akkadians, and the Sumerians. And he for sure let people know this, because after taking Babylon, Cyrus styled himself as King of Babylon, King of Sumer and Akkad, King of the Four Corners of the World. I mean, obviously looking at his dominion on a map of the world, saying the Four Corners sounds a bit outlandish. Depending on your views of Turkey, he didn't make it into Europe, nor did he make it to Eastern Asia, Africa, and definitely not the Americas. But still, he controlled realms that had a sense of power. The Greeks acknowledged Babylon's historical significance. The Egyptians recognized the importance of the rulers in Mesopotamia. Even if Cyrus never conquered those lands, his name would stretch much further than the vague borders of his empire. But the conquest of Babylon meant much more than just the Persians taking control. The Babylonians had also ruled over separate groups within their borders. Kinda comes with the territory of being an empire, ruling over different ethnic and cultural groups. The Babylonians had forced many of these groups from their homelands, with many ending up as slaves in Mesopotamia. One of these groups was the Israelites from the Kingdom of Judah. When Cyrus took power, he allowed these groups to return to their ancestral homes. Well, the Israelites had a term that they used for someone anointed by God, but this term had also been turned into a semi-prophetic term about a person, usually thought to be a king, who would rise up to help the Israelites during their darkest hour. When Cyrus freed the Israelites from the Babylonian exile, they hoisted this term upon him. That is how Cyrus became the only Gentile king ever to be called the Messiah. Now that Cyrus has successfully become king of the four corners of the world, let's talk about how he made that a little easier on himself. After all, one man can't actually rule over an area that large by himself. And that's how we get to the satraps. The word satrap comes from an old Persian term meaning protector of the province, and the position was akin to that of a governor. A satrap ruled over a region called a satrapy. Once he was finished conquering, or at least conquered all that he could in his lifetime, Cyrus had divided his new empire into 26 satrapies, with each more or less corresponding to one of the local major ethnic groups he had conquered in a region. Under previous rulers, different regions of empires were under the command of client kings. These were usually the men the new emperor had conquered or replacements from those who proved to be much more loyal. However, at the end of the day, these client kings were still kings. They had some sort of sway over their local people and usually could attest to some sort of divine right to their rule. Under Cyrus, things were going to be different. Like I said, satraps were essentially the equivalent to provincial governors. No royal or divine notions were associated with the position. They oversaw local bureaucratic situations and acted as a judge for court cases within their provinces. They could also employ a local army to act at their behest if needed. However, Cyrus made sure to let the satraps know that they were in fact just governors and not kings. Each satrapy also had several Persian officials that acted within their provincial palaces that were independent from the rule of the satraps. These officials would personally report back to Cyrus and the future successors of the Achaemenid Empire. Also, Cyrus controlled the actual Persian army. In a sense, the Persian officials within the satrap's court were Cyrus's eyes across the realm. If a satrap started getting too big for their britches, the emperor could come in and easily replace them with someone else. This kind of rule was highly successful under Cyrus because he saw it as his duty to make sure that the satrapies were ruled over by satraps from the local people. A Babylonian satrap ruled over Babylon, a Bactrian satrap ruled over Bactria, so on and so forth. Even if uprisings happened every now and then, things maintained the status quo under Cyrus. And the system would continue, though not as successfully. Under Darius I, who ruled three emperors after Cyrus, the system started to show cracks as satraps started trying to amass more power. After a while, instead of an appointed position, the power of the satrap became a hereditary position. However, the satrapy system would survive throughout the rest of the Achaemenid Empire, and beyond. When Alexander the Great conquered Persia, he continued the system. When he died and his general Seleucus took over Persia, he also kept the satrapies in place. The system would change and evolve over time, with different empires employing it in different ways, with some being more of a federal government like that under Cyrus, while others being more akin to client kings. When the Byzantine Empire was the big name in the area, the rulers of Roman Armenia were referred to by a Greek version of the name, Satrapia. Even in modern Farsi, the Persian language of Iran, the term has been handed down the ages to become Shahrban, and means something equivalent to the mayor of a town. Now that we've seen how Cyrus conquered his way to the top and divided up his empire, how did he actually rule? In historian circles, Cyrus is often viewed as this very benevolent conqueror who was very liberally minded and allowed for freedom of religion and cultural practices. After all, we can see this in how he chose people from the local cultures to serve as satraps. But just how true is that thought? Well, in order to talk more about that, we should first talk about the Cyrus Cylinder. The Cyrus Cylinder is the name of an artifact found in the ruins of Babylon in the late 19th century. It is written in Akkadian cuneiform, the writing system of ancient Babylon, and is alleged to come from not long after Cyrus conquered the Neo-Babylonian Empire. The text on the cylinder is mainly anti-Babylonian propaganda, which insists that Nabonidus was a weak ruler who had been decreed to fail by the god Marduk, who in turn blessed Cyrus with victory over his foe. The text then goes on to explain all that Cyrus had done, or at least had planned to do, now that he was the ruler of Western Asia. He asserts that he returned relics and people to their homelands after a practice Nabonidus had started by taking statues of patron gods from their respective cities. In the ancient world, city-states would have statues of their patron gods within the main temple in their city. To some of the cultures in that part of the world, the statue was not just a representation of that god, but that god themselves. By taking away such relics, Nabonidus had kidnapped the power of these deities. In 1971, Princess Ashraf Pahlavi gave a copy of the Cyrus Cylinder to the Secretary General of the United Nations as part of the 2500-year anniversary of the founding of the Persian Empire. Princess Ashraf, as well as her twin brother Shah Mohammad Reza Pahlavi, the then ruler of Iran, insisted that the Cyrus Cylinder was the oldest declaration of human rights, since the text seemed to imply that Cyrus outlawed slavery within his empire and allowed people to practice their own customs. The UN now holds this copy of the Cyrus Cylinder next to the Egyptian-Hittite Peace Treaty, the oldest surviving peace treaty in the world. However, this interpretation of the Cyrus Cylinder is starting to be viewed as, well, wrong. As I said, the cylinder's text is straight-up propaganda. We can't even confirm for certain that any of these things in it were actually done. While Cyrus may have practiced religious tolerance, one of the lines of text in the cylinder says, "All of the kings in the Westland dwelling in tents brought me their heavy tribute and kissed my feet." At the end of the day, he still lavishes in the idea of being the conquering king who suppressed the rule of others. I know it's pretty about-face of me to suddenly be like, "Hey, actually Cyrus was not a good guy." It's just that Cyrus has always been looked upon as the benevolent conqueror, who actually cared about his subjects. And to that, I gotta say that you've fallen for his propaganda. Maybe he was more lenient towards his subjects compared to the Medians and the Babylonians, but Cyrus still conquered lands and created a superstate under his military control. And even if Cyrus outlawed slavery during his lifetime, that wouldn't last for long, because countless cultures he ruled over, who were under Persian control at the time, would allow their own laws permitting it. And if Cyrus actually did want to be a king who was tolerant of people's customs, that makes it sad in retrospect. He would have ruled over all these people with the hopes of creating a peaceful state, while those underneath him still desired to treat others like dirt. So, unfortunately, it is just easier to imagine him as a king who was smart enough to know, let diverse people have a diverse and representative leadership, but still forceful enough to keep them under his thumb. So, let's get down to the judgment of Cyrus II of Achaemenid Persia, shall we? The man was one of the greatest individual conquerors of the ancient world, probably second only to Alexander the Great. He also created an often overlooked historical predecessor to federal forms of government. Honestly, the only reason I think that Cyrus is not spoken of in equal terms as Alexander the Great is because the latter lived in the Greek sphere of influence and therefore represents more of the Western world. I'm sure that if history had gone another way and white people didn't have such a negative view towards Middle Eastern cultures, Cyrus would also be a historical figure everyone in America and Europe learns about in school. While the idea of a massive empire in Western Asia was nothing new by the time Cyrus took power, other examples obviously here being the Assyrians, Medians, and Neo-Babylonians, he took that type of power to new heights, putting him on equal standing with other greats like Sargon of Akkad. But obviously, Cyrus's form of a massive empire was of a different kind to those that came before him. He acknowledged the strengths and beliefs of those he sought to conquer. He made use of Medes to fight the Median Empire and tried to use the same strategy against the Lydians. And if the records are true of keeping him the kings of the areas he conquered alive and brought them in as advisors, that also recognizes a sense of humility in Cyrus that, just because he conquered them, that didn't mean he knew how to properly rule as a king over various people. I would then fully believe that if Cyrus kept the likes of Astyages and Nabonidus alive, he would have made them satraps of their respective regions. That brings me to the satraps, which were such a success under Cyrus that they were kept in some capacity during later Western Asian empires. The only hit I have against Cyrus isn't even with the man himself, but with how others view him. Because no, I don't think Cyrus was actually a benevolent ruler who outlawed slavery and allowed everyone to live exactly how they wanted. He was probably better than those who came before, but that's not saying much when you have full-blown autocrats in charge. Then again, if anything, that proves how powerful Cyrus's propaganda campaign was. He managed to state his goals in a way that people 2,500 years later are willing to believe he was a model of human rights. That's pretty impressive in its own right. So with all that aside, let's assign a grade to the reign of Cyrus the Great of Persia. I had to think a lot about this one actually, which is funny because these grades are entirely arbitrary at the end of the day. While Cyrus was not the first man to create a sweeping empire in West Asia, he certainly put Persia, and therefore Iran, on the map as major players in the world. Though his empire would not last forever, the version of rule he used was employed and looked upon favorably by those that succeeded him. Heck, the guy who took down his empire was even a massive fan. While he may not have been the perfect ruler everyone seems to want him to be, there's no denying he was great. So for that, I'll give Cyrus an A- on the Were They Great grading scale. He changed the game, albeit briefly, and should be remembered as a man perhaps slightly more thoughtful than those who came before him. And at the end of the day, I think that's all we can really hope for when it comes to the people we put in power. Like all the other kings in this story, Cyrus's death is shrouded in mystery due to various sources citing different stories. Depending on who you're reading, Cyrus may have died in battle, failing at one final conquest, or he died in his capital city of Pasargadae, peacefully after finalizing the consolidation of his rule. No matter which story is true, they all agree that he died around 530 BCE, making him about 70 years old. So if he did die in battle, who did he die to? Again, even that is argued about. It's always agreed though that, for the theories that he did die in battle, that it was against a tribe who he had not already conquered. The most famous account of Cyrus's death is from Herodotus. He claims that Cyrus met his end fighting against the Massagete, a tribe who may have lived somewhere around present-day Uzbekistan and Kazakhstan. The Massagete were led by a woman named Tomyris. After she defeated Cyrus, she had him beheaded. She then allegedly dipped his head in a tub of blood to represent Cyrus's bloodlust in life. For what it's worth, even Herodotus had his doubts about this story, as he apparently also heard many contradicting tales about the end of the first Achaemenid emperor. After Cyrus's death, his son Cambyses took control. He would go on to conquer Egypt, becoming the first pharaoh of the 27th dynasty. After Cambyses, there was a brief intermediate period with a possible pretender to the throne, and then the next ruler was Darius I. I told that whole story back in episode number 18. Darius expanded the empire to its greatest limits, pushing further west, north, and east. And as I've said multiple times, the Achaemenid Empire would eventually be conquered and brought under the heel of Alexander the Great. However, even Alexander himself loved Cyrus. When he conquered Pasargadae, Alexander hoped to see the tomb of a great king who had conquered many lands. However, by that point, the tomb had been robbed, and the great conqueror from Macedonia was overcome with grief. Nonetheless, the tomb was still filled with so much wealth, including artifacts from all across the Persian Empire. An inscription on his tomb also read, O ye man, I am Cyrus, son of Cambyses, who founded the empire of the Persians and was king of Asia. Do not therefore grudge me this monument. Truly, words belonging to one of the greatest kings of conquest. But for now, that's it for this week's episode of Royally Screwed. I hope you enjoyed the journey. Be sure to subscribe to the show and tell a friend all about it. Next time, we're diving into Scandinavian legends to talk about a figure I've mentioned a few times before in passing. For the Vikings who would eventually go on to raid France and the British Isles, a name was passed around with reverence. The men who claimed to be his sons and relatives were looked upon as great leaders. But who was Ragnar Lodbrok, the alleged king of Denmark? And did he actually even exist? I hope you'll join me then for another topsy-turvy look into history's most interesting rulers.